What if that idea you might have, that your brain is sort of set in stone after childhood, what if that's just wrong?
Yeah, completely wrong. What if it's actually this incredibly dynamic thing, capable of changing, pretty profoundly throughout your whole life?
Exactly. And that amazing concept is neuroplasticity.
And that's what we're diving into today. Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take the sources you send us, dig through them, and pull out the key insights, the surprising bits.
Right. And we have a really fascinating stack today. It really focuses on this capacity of the brain to change. And we've got some incredible real-world examples we want to get into.
Definitely. So our mission really is to unpack what neuroplasticity actually is, touch on the basics of how it works, and then, yeah, spend some good time on those examples because they show it in action so well.
The goal is for you to walk away with a solid grasp of how your brain can change, but, without feeling totally overwhelmed by the jargon.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay, let's get into it. So first things first, what are we actually talking about with neuroplasticity?
Well, the word plasticity itself is a good place to start, actually. It means, easily shaped, moldable, like clay.
Okay, so not rigid, flexible.
Exactly. Soft enough to change shape.
Yeah.
And then you stick neuro on the front, and we're talking about the nervous system, the brain.
Gotcha.
So one definition we found puts it as the capacity of neurons and neural networks. Basically, the brain's wiring
what?
To change their connections and how they behave.
And this change happens in response to stuff.
Yeah, in response to new information, sensory input, development, even damage or dysfunction.
That definition alone really pushes back against the older way of thinking, doesn't it? This idea that the brain gets wired up early on and that's kind of it.
Oh, absolutely. That was the thinking for a long time. Things get fixed after a certain developmental window closes.
Mm-hmm.
But the research in recent decades, it's just overwhelming, as our sources show. This is ongoing. It happens throughout life.
So your brain can change when you're older.
Definitely. Now, the amount of change, or maybe the type of change, that might shift over time, but the capacity's there.
And it's not just one single thing happening. Like, it can be small changes or big reorganizations.
Precisely. You can have tiny adjustments right at the synapse, the little gap between neurons, or you can see these huge shifts across large brain networks. It's happening constantly on different scales.
Okay, so if the brain is constantly changing, how does it actually pull that off? What are the mechanics behind it that the sources talk about?
Well, the sources point to a few key mechanisms at the cellular level. You can sort of think about them as structural changes versus functional changes, although honestly, that line can get pretty blurry.
Okay. And one big one mentioned is long-term potentiation. LTP.
Yes, LTP. It's really fundamental for what we call synaptic plasticity. Basically, it's where a connection between neurons gets stronger if it's stimulated repeatedly in a certain pattern.
So like the more you use a pathway, the stronger it gets, like practicing something.
That's a great analogy, yeah. It becomes more efficient. The sources describe experiments where they stimulate one pathway, say pathway one, repeatedly at a high frequency. Then later, even a normal signal through pathway one gets a much bigger response compared to like pathway two that wasn't stimulated that way.
Ah, so it's potentiated.
Exactly. And it's thought to be a key cellular mechanism for learning and memory. They mentioned specific brain pathways where this is studied, like connections in the hippocampus or between the thalamus and the cortex.
Okay, so LTP makes connections stronger. Is there an opposite, a way to weaken them?
Yep, that's long-term depression or LTD. It's pretty much the reverse. If you stimulate a pathway repeatedly, but at a low frequency, the connection can actually get weaker. The response gets smaller over time.
So the brain can fine-tune things, dialing connections up or down based on how much they're used or maybe how they're used?
That's exactly it. This ability to strengthen and weaken is crucial for refining the networks, for adapting. And then there's another big one, synaptic pruning.
Okay, the gardening analogy, right. Cutting back the extra growth.
Perfect analogy. It's basically the brain eliminating synapses, those connections, that aren't used much or are less active.
Yeah.
And this is really dramatic during development.
Right. You mentioned development. How does that timing work?
Well, the sources show this huge burst of synapse formation really early, peaking around age two, maybe, just tons of connections being made.
Wow.
But then from about age two up to maybe 10 or so, there's this massive pruning phase, a really dramatic cutting back. And it keeps going just more slowly through the teen years and into early adulthood. It really sculpts the brain, especially areas like the prefrontal cortex that finish developing later.
So the brain overbuilds connections and then sort of chisels itself down based on what's actually needed, based on experience.
Precisely. It's about efficiency, specialization. A really cool example is the visual cortex. Early on, it might have connections related to touch or hearing, but as vision becomes the main input, those other connections get pruned away. But, and this is fascinating, if someone is visually impaired from birth, those connections don't get pruned as much. And that area, the visual cortex, can actually get taken over and used by other senses, like touch for reading Braille or for hearing.
That is incredible, that repurposing. And the sources mention some theories linking pruning issues to certain conditions, with caveats, of course.
They did. And yeah, it's important to stress, these are still theories, research is ongoing, and pruning wouldn't be the only factor. But there are ideas out there, like maybe schizophrenia is linked to the too much pruning in adolescence, which kind of fits with when it often emerges. And conversely, maybe conditions like autism or Savant syndrome could involve too little pruning, leading to different, maybe more numerous or atypical patterns of connection. But again, early days on that research.
Still, it shows how fundamental these mechanisms are. Okay, so beyond those core processes, the sources also mention ways the brain compensates, especially after, say, an injury.
Yes, definitely. These highlight the brain's resilience. One is adult neurogenesis.
Neurogenesis, like generating new neurons in adults.
Exactly. Generating new functional neurons from adult stem or precursor cells. Finding this happens at all in adults was a huge deal because the old view was no new neurons after a certain point.
Wow. Does it happen everywhere?
No, the sources are clear. It's pretty restricted. It happens mainly in specific zones, like parts of the hippocampus, which is heavily involved in memory.
Okay, so new neurons, but only in certain spots. What else? You mentioned equipotentiality and vicariation. They sound a bit similar.
They do, but there's a key distinction the sources make. Equipotentiality is more local. It's the idea that within one specific area of the cortex, if part of it gets damaged, an intact part within that same area can potentially take over the function.
So like neighbors helping out within the same department?
Kind of, yeah. But vicariation is bigger picture. That's when a whole different brain area or system steps up to compensate for the function lost in a damaged area.
Ah, like a different department taking over the work entirely.
Exactly. And the sources give great examples. After a stroke damaging one side of the brain, connections on the unaffected side might strengthen to help recover movement, for instance.
Okay.
Or after a traumatic brain injury, you might see new connections forming between different regions involved in memory to try and compensate for damage elsewhere.
Makes sense.
And with sensory loss, hearing loss might lead to visual areas becoming more involved in processing sound cues. And in vision loss, like we discussed with pruning, the visual cortex itself can get recruited by hearing or touch. That's a prime example of vicariation.
So different brain teams pitching in. And what about diastasis? That sounds different again.
Diastasis is usually temporary. It's when you see a decrease in function in a brain area, not because it's damaged itself, but because an area it's connected to is damaged. It's like a ripple effect or a system shock.
Okay, so downstream effects.
Right. And function often recovers as the brain adjusts. Think about temporary issues right after a stroke or near a site where brain surgery happened, or even after a concussion. Those can be examples of diastasis before things stabilize.
Got it. So putting this all together, it paints a picture of a brain that's not just changeable, but really resilient and adaptable. Yeah. But is it equally plastic throughout our lives, or does it decline?
Well, generally speaking, plasticity is definitely most active, most vigorous in early development. You know, those first few years with all that synapse formation and pruning, building the basic architecture.
Right.
But, and the sources are really emphatic about this, it absolutely continues throughout life. Learning new things, forming memories, adapting to new situations. That is neuroplasticity happening at any age.
But it's not magic, right? It can't fix everything.
No. Crucially, it's not a cure-all. The sources make sure to point this out. Some parts of the brain just seem less plastic than others and really severe damage. Well, even with the brain's amazing ability to compensate, sometimes the deficits can't be fully overcome.
So there are limits.
There are limits. Recovery depends on so much age, where the damage is, how bad it is, and things like rehabilitation efforts play a huge role too.
Okay. So we've covered what it is, the basic mechanisms, how the brain compensates. Now for the really cool stuff. Let's dive into those specific examples from the sources that just show this power in action.
Yes, these really bring the concepts to life. One of the most famous, almost iconic examples is the study on London taxi drivers.
Ah, yes. The knowledge, I've heard about this. They have to memorize the entire layout of London, right? Thousands of streets.
Exactly. Yeah. It's incredibly complex, not just maps, but routes, landmarks, one-way systems. It takes years. So researchers looked at the brains of licensed taxi drivers compared to controls.
And they found actual structural differences in adults.
Yes, that's the amazing part. Significant changes in the hippocampus, that memory region we mentioned. Specifically, they found more gray matter volume, basically more neuronal cell bodies and connections in the back part, the posterior hippocampus. And get this, the amount of extra gray matter correlated with how long they'd been driving a taxi. More experience, bigger posterior hippocampus.
So the brain physically changed in response to that intense spatial learning task.
Precisely. Interestingly, the front part, the anterior hippocampus, was slightly smaller in the taxi drivers, suggesting maybe a reorganization or specialization within the hippocampus itself.
Incredible. What about learning something else complex, like a second language? Does that change the brain too?
It does. There was a paper mentioned in our sources from 2004, I think, that looked at this. Learning a second language also leads to structural reorganization. They found increased gray matter density, so again, more dense packing of neurons or connections, in a specific area of the left inferior parietal cortex.
And was that linked to how good they were or how old they were when they learned?
Both. The increase in density was greater the more proficient the person was in the second language. And tying back to our earlier point about age, the density was higher if they started learning the language younger.
So experience shapes the brain structure, but maybe more easily or differently when you're young?
Seems that way. It's experience-driven plasticity, definitely. But with that age factor playing a role.
We also touched on compensation for sensory loss, like visual impairment. That seemed like a really powerful example.
Absolutely. It's a stunning demonstration of how the brain repurposes itself. If the visual cortex doesn't get visual input, especially early on, it doesn't just, you know, shut down. The sources show it gets recruited by other senses.
Touch, hearing,
maybe even smell. It starts processing information from those senses instead.
And you mentioned it matters when the vision loss happens.
Yes. If it's congenital, from birth, the effect seems stronger. You see greater cortical thickness in those repurposed visual areas, stronger plasticity effects compared to someone losing vision later. And that ties right back to pruning, right?
Right, because those other sensory connections weren't pruned away early on.
Exactly. They were available to be strengthened and used for other things.
Repurposing a whole chunk of brain real estate. That's vicariation on a grand scale. There was another sensory one-two-sighted people learning Braille.
Yeah, another neat study. They followed sighted adults learning Braille over, I think it was 8 months, using different kinds of brain scans. And they saw changes.
Functional changes, like which areas lit up.
Yes, functional changes using fMRI. Areas usually involved in visual reading, like a spot called the ventral occipitotemporal cortex, started adapting and responding to tactile input from reading Braille.
And structural changes, too.
Yes. They also measured structural things like gray matter volume and myelin, the insulation around nerve fibers. They saw changes there, too, in sensory areas. It shows plasticity has these different aspects, function, structure, and different methods can reveal different parts of the picture.
Fascinating. Now, beyond these group studies, the sources highlighted some really inspiring individual cases. These really hit home, showing compensatory plasticity after major, major brain damage.
These stories are incredible. Just jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
There was Cheryl Schultz. She lost her sense of balance completely because an antibiotic damaged her vestibular system.
Oh, wow. That must have been debilitating.
Terribly.
Yeah.
But she used this experimental device. It sensed her head movements and translated them into electrical pulses on her tongue.
On her tongue.
A completely new artificial sensory input. And her brain, deprived of the normal balance signals, learned to interpret these tongue sensations, and she regained her sense of balance.
That's unbelievable. The brain just figured out how to use this completely alien input.
Mind-blowing adaptation.
Yeah.
Then there was the case of the 6-year-old boy. He had severe seizures from a tumor, and they had to remove about a third of his right brain hemisphere, including crucial visual processing areas.
A third of his hemisphere. At 6, you'd expect huge problems.
You absolutely would. But remarkably, his left hemisphere basically rewired itself and took over those visual functions, like recognizing faces and objects, tasks usually dominated by the right side. His cognition was largely intact. His IQ even went up slightly after the surgery.
In a 6-year-old, that level of rewiring is just
profound. It shows the immense plasticity possible in a young brain facing a massive challenge.
And there was another hemispherectomy case, Maura Lieb, wasn't there? Even younger.
Yes, Maura had a stroke before she was born that damaged her left hemisphere, the typical side for language and motor control. They removed that entire hemisphere when she was only 9 months old.
9 months old.
And her remaining right hemisphere, with a lot of therapy and support, learned to handle speech, language, movement, functions normally managed by the side that was removed. It's just an incredible testament to infant brain plasticity.
These individual stories are truly powerful. So thinking about all this, the mechanisms, the examples you suggest, the sources suggest some brain areas are just inherently more plastic or maybe better at recovery than others.
Yeah, it seems there are differences, although it's nuanced. It depends a bit on what kind of plasticity you mean. For general learning, adapting to experience, areas like the hippocampus, the visual cortex, the motor cortex, the prefrontal cortex areas heavily involved in those functions seem very plastic.
Okay, those are the adaptable learners. What about bouncing back from damage?
There, the sources suggest maybe the hippocampus and the motor cortex have a somewhat better shot at functional recovery compared to, say, the visual cortex or the prefrontal cortex, though again, it's complex.
Why the hippocampus and motor cortex?
Well, the hippocampus has that adult neurogenesis, the ability to make new neurons, which might help. And the motor cortex seems quite capable of reorganization, especially with rehabilitation.
So maybe the visual cortex is great at being repurposed if you lose sight early on, but harder to recover actual vision if it's damaged later.
That seems to be the implication from the sources, yes. And then some areas, like maybe the basal ganglia deep in the brain or the primary auditory cortex, are sometimes thought of as potentially less plastic overall.
Okay, so let's try and pull this all together. What's the big takeaway from this deep dive?
I think the clearest message from all these sources is that the brain is absolutely not static. It's not a fixed machine. It's fundamentally dynamic, constantly changing, capable of rewiring itself right throughout our lives.
From those London taxi drivers, literally growing parts of their hippocampus.
Right, to the changes from learning a language, to the visual cortex being repurposed in blindness, or those incredible stories of recovery after losing huge parts in the brain.
Yeah, those individual cases are stunning.
They really are. They all point to the power of these underlying mechanisms, LTP, LTD, pruning, neurogenesis, vicariation, working together to allow the brain to adapt. Adapt to learning, to experience, and even to pretty serious injury.
It really changes how you think about the brain, doesn't it? From something fixed to something alive and adaptable.
Absolutely. And that leaves us with a really powerful thought, doesn't it? If your brain is constantly physically changing based on what you do, what you experience, what you learn.
What does that mean for us?
Well, what does that imply about the power you have? Through the choices you make, the things you decide to learn, the effort you put into practicing a skill, the environments you choose to be in, you are actively participating in shaping your own brain. It really raises the question of how much agency we have in sculpting this incredible organ throughout our lives.